the Columbia Workshop under the direction of Irving Reese.
High up on a building on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, immortalized in granite are these words of Abraham Lincoln.
The patent system added the fuel of interest to the fire of genius.
The American patent system is perhaps the strongest single bulwark of democratic government. Under its protection and encouragement, inventive genius flourished and made of a small, struggling nation the greatest industrial power in the history of the world. Because of the contribution of the American patent system to civilization, the Columbia Workshop is proud to dedicate this program to the 100th anniversary celebration of the United States Patent Office. Let us turn back the pages of history to Venice in 1594. In the Hall of the Doge, a young man fingers a petition nervously while a group of nobles stare.
Very well, I am ready. Speak up, young man.
If it please your highness, I have prepared a paper.
Then read it quickly.
Yes, your highness. Your humble servant has invented a machine for raising water and irrigating land at small expense and great convenience. It seems not fit that this invention, which is my own, discovered by me with great labor and much expense, be made the common property of everybody. I humbly petition your serene highness that you deign to favor me with a right, so that no one but myself or my heirs be allowed to make this new instrument. By reason of your benignity thereof, I shall more attentively apply myself to new inventions for universal benefit.
Yes, go on.
That is all, my lord.
You believe, then, that if I grant this right, you will apply yourself to other beneficial inventions?
Yes, your highness.
Very well. Scribe.
Your highness?
Cause to be entered that from this day on, for 20 years, no other man shall have the right to make this machine.
Yes, your highness. Your name?
Galilei Galileo.
On the proofs of Galileo's promise,
I shall more attentively apply myself to new inventions for universal benefit.
The world has long been aware. Thus was a young man, destined to be one of the world's greatest scientific minds, encouraged by the Doge of Venice. But such was not the case with other all-powerful nobles, or in other countries, and such great abuses existed under governments in which one person had the power to create or destroy inventors' rights based on whim or favor, that few were encouraged to devote their energies toward invention. It is of everlasting tribute to the founding fathers of the new nation of the United States of America that in spite of all the weighty problems occupying the Constitutional Convention in 1787, their wisdom and foresight caused to be included as Section 8, Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States of America.
The Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writing and discovery.
The first Patent Act passed by the federal government was enacted on April 10, 1790, a little over a year after the founding of the new government. The members of the first board were Henry Knox, Edmund Randolph, and Thomas Jefferson. Almost as a reward for the founding fathers' vision, the fate smiled on the small, struggling agricultural nation, not 2 years later, when a young student named Eli Whitney, fresh out of Yale, left for Savannah, Georgia, to visit the cotton plantation of his friend, Mrs. Nathaniel Green. It is an afternoon in the summer of 1792. Young Whitney, who has shown a marked aptitude for mechanical design, watches a group of Negroes in the shed of the plantation.
This is Mr. Stiles, Mr. Whitney, my overseer.
Oh, how do you do, Mr. Stiles?
How do you do, sir?
Your people work hard here.
Yes, sir. Seeding cotton takes a long time. We've got shipments to make regularly.
Tell me, do they have to pick each seed out of a cotton ball by hand?
Yes, sir.
It seems there should be some easier way of doing it.
Well, it's hardly possible. A machine had damaged the tendon fiber.
I waited Mr. Whitney could make a machine that would. He'd make some very clever things for me.
He would earn the gratitude of the whole South.
It might be done.
Oh, no, Eli. You're here for a vacation. I won't have you worrying about cotton.
Why, a machine could do all that work in an hour. By George, I will do it.
The backbreaking burden of the Negro slaves preyed on the mind of Eli Whitney, In 5 weeks, he carried a strange-looking spiked roller into the shed.
Hello, Mr. Whitney.
Hello, Mr. Stiles. Could I interrupt your work for a few moments?
Why, yes, sir. All right, boys. Take a rest. Well, what's that you've got there, Mr. Whitney?
That's a cotton gin, Mr. Stiles. I think it may work. May I set it here?
Sure, set it right down here.
Now, can you have one of the slaves bring me a basket of cotton bowls?
Well, are you sure Mrs. Green won't mind? You know, cotton's pretty expensive, and those spikes are ruining.
I'm sure Mrs. Green won't mind. Just a handful will do.
Yeah, all right. Is this enough?
Yes. Just put it under the wheel.
Right here?
Yeah, that's it, right there. Now, I'll just turn this handle.
What happens now?
It should come out here. There. Yes. Here's a ball of it.
May I see it? Great day. You've done it, Mr. Whitney. Save a single seed left.
The three revolutions of the wheel of the first cotton gin spelled the end of one era and the beginning of another, which was to see a land with some few thousand acres of cotton under cultivation spread to millions of acres of the billowy white plant, and the growth of the South to the most important agricultural section in the world. The rapid growth of the nation soon made obsolete the patent laws of 1790 and the subsequent laws of 1793. In 1836, 100 years ago, Senator John Ruggles introduced a new patent law, which established the present patent system as a model for the world to follow. That year truly saw the birth of American industrial supremacy. Some 2 million inventions America has since given the world. The Columbia Workshop is proud to help share in the centennial celebration of the United States patent system by reviewing the story behind some of the outstanding contributions of American scientific genius. The top floor of a boarding house at 5 Exeter Place, Boston, on a night in March, 1876.
Mr. Bell, if Mrs. Hewitt hears this, we'll be thrown out, apparatus and all. We'd better go to bed and start again early tomorrow. Oh, nothing.
There, that little thumbscrew will hold. If I could only stretch that diaphragm a wee bit tighter. Oh, confound that hammer.
There goes our room and board.
Why?
Mrs. Hewitt has complained 3 times this week about the noise. There, she's coming up the stairs now.
Well, I'll run into the front room, hook up that old battery, and make the adjustments. I'll fix the transmitter in there. We can make a test after you get rid of her.
After I... Come in. Ah, good evening, Mrs. Hewitt. Please come in.
It's not evening, Mr. Watson. It's night. You and your friend will have to stop that noise.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Hewitt, we'll
And if you keep burning the gas this late, I'll have to increase your rent.
Well, of course we
expect... And the way you litter this room with all those wires. What are you men doing?
Mrs. Hewitt, Mr. Bell is a great man. Someday, maybe the world will remember that this house, because of these wires. Someday, the world will be able to talk through these wires, Mrs. Hewitt.
Mr. Watson, you've been drinking.
No, Mrs. Hewitt, think of it. People will be able to hear through it for blocks all the way from Boston to New York. Will you please hold this wire? I've got to fight the connection.
Oh, all right. But why can't your friend hold it?
Well, Mr. Bell did the front room making the connection.
The wire's alive. It bit me.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was an accident. Mr. Bell must have opened the circuit. I wonder
Mr.
why...
Mr. Watson, come here. I want you.
Why, that's Mr. Bell's voice. I thought he was in the front room.
Listen.
Mr. Watson, come here quickly.
He is in the front room. We've got it. Alexander, we've got it.
If the gods of accident and chance smiled that day when Mr. Watson said, all the way from Boston to New York, it was only because they alone could peek into the future of Alexander Graham Bell's great discovery. The telephone became an integral part of American life. Boston was chosen for the first long-distance line. As the culmination of 10 years of experiment, a group of distinguished persons stand around a shiny new telephone.
I think they're ready in New York, Mr. Bale.
Oh, fine.
What do I do?
Well, just hold this to your mouth. That's it. Now, you listen here.
Yes, thank you.
Are you ready, sir?
Yes.
Quiet, please. Quiet. I'll ring them.
Hello?
Hello? This is New York.
This is Edward J. Bale. Speak a little louder, please.
How is it up there in Boston?
It's fine up here in Boston. I can hear you very plainly. How is it down in New York? Good. The first New York to Boston telephone line is a success. I predict that one day people will be able to talk as far as from New York to Chicago.
I wish to speak to Mr. Harold Gear in Shanghai, China. Mr. James Brewster in New York is calling.
New York calling Shanghai, China. One moment, please.
Hello, operator. I want to talk to Mrs. Franklin Harris on board the Aquitania. They're about 1,200 miles at sea now.
The Aquitania. One moment, please.
This is long distance. Operator, this is the Amalgamated Smelling Company. Please cross connect our offices in Seattle, San Diego, Chicago, Baltimore, and Tampa for a conference call.
Just a moment, please.
So the few feet of wire which carried the first words of Alexander Graham Bell accidentally, after he had spilled some acid and called for his assistant, spread into a network of 150 million miles of lines over five continents, carrying 69 million calls a day. But if the first words carried over a line were strange, stranger words still signalized another historic milestone in American invention less than a year later. It is the laboratory of a young scientist in Menlo Park, New Jersey.
Hold this crossbar, Weaver.
Yes, sir.
Now, when I say ready...
Come, will you stop being mysterious and tell us just what that strange thing is?
This machine will talk, Cruzy. Yes, sir, it'll talk. Where'd I put that tin for?
Well, the chief's going balmy.
Let's gang up on him for a bet.
Good idea.
Yeah, yeah. What are you plotting with my bookkeeper, Cruzy?
Nothing, Tom. We're just talking about this machine. You say it'll talk?
Yes.
I'll bet you $2 it won't.
I'll put up a handful of cigars. Expensive ones, too. It'll cost a dime each.
Well, I haven't got a dollar, Cruzy, but I'll put up a barrel of apples.
Done. I'll split them with you, Carbon.
Well, those are good cigars. Half a barrel isn't enough.
All right, Weaver. I want you to turn this crank evenly like this. And try
yes,
to keep the revolutions uniform about 1 second.
Right.
I'll have to bend close to the mouthpiece. Are you ready?
Yes, sir. But what will you say?
I hadn't thought of that. Let me see. I've got it. Ready, Weaver. Turn. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. All right, Weaver, that's enough.
Are those Macintosh apples, Tom, or Rome beauties?
Yes, and you'll have to transport them to our homes, Tom.
We'll use the $2 to buy more tinfoil, Weaver. Just throw the cigars out. Now we'll set the needle back. Now, when I signal, turn the crank at the same speed. Would you like to listen, Mr. Cruzy, and you too, Carmen?
Sure, of course.
Hold this to your ear. All ready, Weaver. Turn.
I hope they're good apples.
It worked, Mr. Addison. It worked.
Thus, with the words of a nursery rhyme, man's voice was first captured and imprisoned on a sheet of tin foil. From its humble beginning, like all great new inventions, it inspired a host of other inventions, culminating with the sound motion picture. Edison's phonograph was given a number, took its place beside the telephone in the records of the patent office.
Lacking the power to fly, man must finish his own, as the birds do. And what is a bird, Giovanni, but a machine governed by mechanical laws? Let me but discover those laws, and I shall construct a machine that man can fly.
So 400 years ago spoke Leonardo da Vinci, artist, scientist, inventor, engineer, to his assistant Giovanni. But great genius that he was, even da Vinci was not the first man to dream of flight or fail in its realization. Since Ovid sang of Icarus 2,000 years ago in ancient Rome, man has yearned to conquer space with wings. But like the mythical Icarus who sought to fly to the sun, only to have the irate gods melt his wings and plunge into his doom, man has been rebuked for centuries for attempting to soar. It is a far cry from the songs of Ovid in ancient Rome and the dreams of da Vinci in Florence 400 years ago to a bicycle repair shop in Dayton, Ohio in 1902, where two brothers talk while working.
Here comes Father, Wilbur. Is his bike ready?
Yep, just finished.
Catherine's with him.
Good. Hello, Father.
Hello, Catherine.
Hello.
Your bicycle's finished, Father.
Well, I didn't come about that.
Anything wrong?
Boys, you will have to stop those glider flights. You've been disappointing the village undertaker for months.
They couldn't stop now, Father.
Oh, it's too late to quit.
Your business is going to pieces. You're the laughingstock of the whole town. You'll both break your necks before you finish.
Please, Father.
You've already flown the glider. You've found out that it stays up. What are you after now?
Power.
Yes, Dad. We can't depend on winds anymore. We need an engine. We've got to give our bird a heart so that it can fly itself.
But there isn't an engine in the country light enough to lift its own weight off the ground, Orville.
Then we'll make one.
You really think you can?
Yes, Father. It's going to be hard. It'll take time and patience. But we've gone this far, and we're going to see it through.
Kitty Hawk, South Carolina, the morning of December 17th, 1903. A knife-edged wind blows across the bleak sand dunes. A handful of Kitty Hawk citizens, including the local newspaper man, half frozen, watch two men work with ebbing curiosity.
Pull that brake tight, Orville.
Yeah. There, how's that?
Good. Yeah, the wind's dying a bit, Will. How about giving her a trial?
Well, if you say so, sure. Well, we've got to get that machine on the track, though.
All right. Maybe some of these fellows will help us. Say, will you lend a hand here, fellas?
Sure. What do you want us to do?
We want to lift this machine on the track.
It weighs 750 pounds. But if the seven of us help, it shouldn't be hard.
Well, is that all? Heck, I can lift it myself.
All right, see when.
No, over there. All right, all together now. Come
on,
out with it. Good. Ease her down now. Easy.
Thanks very much, boys.
All right,
Wilbur. Strap yourself in.
Oh, no, Orville. We tossed the coin 4 days ago.
But you won then, Will.
Well, I had my chance. That restraining wire slipped.
Yes, I know, and you didn't go up. So it's still your chance.
Now, don't argue. We've waited long enough. Get in.
As you say.
Strap?
Yep.
You got the benzene on?
Benzene on.
Now, the switch on?
Switch on. Give the propeller a crank.
All right.
I'll warm up a bit, Orville. All right.
Mr. Wright, I'd like to have a word with you. I'm Hayes, a friend.
Sure, Mr. Hayes.
Would you mind stepping over here? They'll never hear each other.
Not at all.
Now, what can I do for you?
Well, Mr. Wright, I won't be saying about all this in my paper, but you fellas don't really think that that'll lift off the ground, do you?
Well, can't really say, Mr. Haynes. We think it will, but you'll be able to tell in a minute.
But I think that the...
All right, Orville, coming. Sorry, Mr. Haynes, I gotta see my brother.
Well, do you think they'll make it, Haynes?
Well, I think they're darn fools. What do you think?
I can't say. Gotta show them money they deserve to. After all that work.
Good luck, Orville!
He's starting!
They're kind of slow, though.
Of American genius into a portrait of a new day and age. If democratic government is on trial in the conflicts of the nations, the gifts to mankind that Americans have made never can be. For by the dreams of these men, the world can fly, hurl electric words across oceans, transmit human knowledge by speedy mechanical fingers, and live in a more complete world than the founders of a struggling new democratic nation founded when they made provisions for the American patent system. The Columbia Workshop has just presented a review of the history of the American patent system and the story behind some of the great inventions it encouraged in the past. It is now our pleasure to let you hear Mr. Justin W. Macklin, First Assistant Commissioner of the United States Patent Office, who will tell you something of the future of the patent system. We now transfer you to Washington, D.C.
The variety of inventions and experiences of the past have frequently led to the question, has everything of any importance been invented? Those who have studied the history of inventions answer emphatically no. In 1845, the first commissioner, Patents Ellsworth, said his resignation was of no great concern because mankind had achieved all of which it was capable, at least in the direction of material perfection. Since then, we have seen the telegraph span continents and oceans. Then came the telephone and later the radio. At a time of the beginning of the radio, with its dot and dash signals from station to station and from ship to shore, the horseless carriage clattered down our streets. Even at that time, the present vast industrial extent of the automobile could hardly have been foreseen by the bravest of prophets. Yet it is one, or only one, of the many industries that have grown up since the beginning of this century. We do not know what the future holds. This we do know. That scientific research and engineering developments as they relate to inventions and patented improvements are being carried forward on a vast scale and in a most business-like manner. Most of us living now will see changes as surprising as the developments of the telephone, radio, railroad, steamboat, airplane, electric lamp, vulcanized rubber, and the marvels of chemistry. Present electrical and mechanical devices will be much more widely used. The nature of our homes will be changed in architecture and materials of construction. The most modern apartment with its complete living units and conveniences, dining service, retail stores, is but a suggestion of the future apartments, perfectly air-conditioned, ideally lighted, and conveniently accessible. Push buttons and dial telephones may be replaced by automatic devices responsive to the commands of our voice. The individual homes of the suburbs and country are bound to change rapidly. Great expansion of industry will be involved. Steel homes are but the beginning. Materials not before used but present in abundance will be brought into the solution of the housing problem. Houses will be comfortable the year round in all climates, and sanitary beyond our present concept of the meaning of that word. Few, if any, will be so unfortunate as not to have the privilege of living in such homes in the future. The new Zephyr trains are forerunners of rail travel of the future. Travel times will be much shortened under conditions of greater safety. The airliners of the future will cross continents and oceans on pathways as definite as to altitudes and direction as the straightest railway track. Great airships will take off and land with the accuracy of the schedule of commuters' trains, day and night, in clear weather, fog, or storm. The number of our airports will, of course, greatly increase. Automobile transportation, as we know it today, has many problems which must be solved. The problems of road crossings and of automobile parking and storage need only to be thought of as having been worked out ideally to envision the actual conditions in a very short time. For example, automobile parking and storage in the cities will be like the handling of airplanes on an airplane carrier. Driving to the hotel or theater, one will step out of his car and it will drop from sight to be returned to the owner promptly on call. We're all looking forward to the advent of television. Developments in the photoelectric cell and other electrical marvels are bringing practical use of television nearer every day. Soon television will take us to the scene of action of news events of peace or war, accident or parade. We may watch distant football games now where we only listen. In the realms of science, we may expect many surprises. For instance, in the near future, electrical microscopes will give us details of minute wonders, seen with enlargements many times that of which glass lenses are now capable. And by the same token, electrical telescopes may take us hundreds of millions of light years of distance farther out into the universe. We will also be able to see in the dark. With all these things, there must follow the development of human engineering. Our relations to each other in the community, state, and nation must be studied and improved in proportion to our development of instrumentalities which serve man. Not only will man's material surroundings be affected by the scientific discoveries of the future, but the very timber of his existence will be profoundly changed. Thinkers will deal with our great social and economic problems. Our ancient enemies, disease, ignorance, poverty, and crime, will be eliminated.
Thank you, Commissioner Macklin. We return you to our New York studio.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just listened to Mr. Justin W. Macklin, First Assistant Commissioner of Patents, who spoke on the future of American invention as a conclusion to a dramatic review of the history of the American patent system and some of the outstanding inventions of the past 100 years. The Columbia Workshop is proud of its opportunity in sharing in the centennial celebration of the United States Patent Office. This program was written and directed by Irving Reese. The author wishes to acknowledge his indebtedness to the United States Patent Office and the many other sources from which he borrowed liberally in the preparation of this presentation.
Tune in next week for the workshop's presentation of one of the outstanding experimental dramatic scripts, Rhythm of the Jute Mill, by William Robson. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.